Public Affairs today, June 19, 2003, and colleagues, the order of the agenda today will be first a work session on possible introduction of speaker-approved bills. And that's LC 3675 that's before you. Then we will go to a work session on Senate Bill 7, and then a public hearing on House Bill 3638. We will then have, should be about time to do the public hearing on Senate Bill 272. And then we will end with another work session on possible consideration of speaker-approved measure drafting requests. So, and that one, you'll have another request before you before the hearing is through today. So, with that, then, let's open up a work session on possible introduction of speaker-approved bills. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move LC 3675 be introduced as a committee bill.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved Legislative Council Draft 3675 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion? Representative Barker.
Thank you. This is part of the continuing resolution, so-called. Okay. Thanks.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Got nods from several people.
All right. Other questions? Discussion? Any objections? All right. So ordered. We'll close the work session and we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 7. And colleagues, we have the Dash 5 amendments still up for consideration, and just as a just brief introduction or on another issue, it turns out that the Senate bill, as it came over to us, nor this amendment, has an emergency clause applied to it. And so we will have a little discussion on whether to have an emergency clause go in or not, mainly because if we do not do that, then having this foundation's would not actually go into effect until January 1 of next year, and we would miss then the opportunity for the current fair that's being set up for not another month from now, 2 months from now. So that is another issue to discuss. But one of the issues that came up last week from various members was just concern that that the additional accountability provisions of this amendment might be difficult for the center to comply with, or you know, that is it looking at the necessity of that. And to help respond to those questions, we held off on actually dealing with this amendment until we could get some answers, at least some additional information from some folks. And I've asked Director of Audits, Kathy Polino, to be here to present at least some information of what's happened with other departments that have some kind of foundation or other third parties that help them with fundraising and some of the issues that they have dealt with through their audit function. So with that, Kathy Polino, if you can come forward. And just as she's coming forward, as one final issue is that the Dash 5 amendments, Legislative Fiscal Office has determined that it has minimal fiscal impact, meaning less than $50,000, so there's no need for any referral to Ways and Means on that as well. So, Ms. Polino, if as you've kind of seen where we are with this issue, I know we've had conversations before about things that the Audit Division has looked at with the Parks Department, and I think there's one other as well.
Higher Ed.
Maybe you can just kind of give us some background on the need for arm's-length relationships between these kind of entities.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kathy Polino, Director of the Secretary of State Audits Division. I just wanted to, as you move forward with Senate Bill 7, wanted to provide to you, kind of from an auditor's perspective, a couple things to keep in mind. Maybe we can use some lessons learned from past audits that we've had, because it is easy for relationships between state agencies and fundraising, either trusts or foundations over time to change and to evolve. And so it's real important up front to establish a couple of basic principles. I wanted to share with you just two of those. And first is one is that need to maintain that arm's length relationship between the state agency and that fundraising entity. If the entity that's raising funds becomes too dependent on the state agency for extensive support, then that trust or foundation loses that independent status, and it really hampers it over time. And so that importance to keep that relationship separate is important. We had some problems with state parks a few years back where that relationship got a little bit too close. And so maintaining that, and then number two, and this one being kind of, I think, most applicable to what you're dealing with right now, is that if there's any payments or assistance provided from the state agency to the organization, there should be some kind of a specific or defined deliverable coming back to the state agency. What this will give you basically up front is some more accountability. If you establish up front what the state agency is going to provide for this fundraising unit, whether it's a certain number of tickets, assistance setting up a booth, whatever it happens to be, establish that up front, and then also establish what that entity is going to do in return for that outlay. They're going to provide X, Y, and Z service back to the state or do certain activities. If you have that established up front, it gives you that first accountability so the state agency can hold the fundraising entity to that agreement. But then it also allows the state agency to account to the public how they use those funds and what they gave to the foundation and what we were expecting to receive in return. So that's the first piece of accountability. Second, it's going to help you in decision making if you have that agreement up front. Later on, maybe next year when we go to look at what did we do, what did we get in return, what were the results, if you have some sort of accounting for what was given and what we got back, you can make some better decisions in the future when you go to make future payments in that area. So I just kind of make those two cautions. Make sure you maintain that arm's length relationship and then have an accountability mechanism so it's clear what we're giving and what we're expecting in return. And again, when you're talking fundraising, it's impossible from the start to say you're going to get exactly this many dollars back in fundraising. You try different avenues, you see what happens. But if you get up front, here's the services they're going to provide for this X number of tickets, they're going to do these certain things, then you can kind of use that, see what happens in the future, see what rolls in, and then make better decisions next time you go out. So I just wanted to leave that with you.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you help us see how the -5s relate to the two issues that you just raised with us?
Yeah, not sure I have those with me. And we really haven't looked closely at the what the proposal is, Mr. Chairman.
Maybe I should say that in looking at this, this looks like an attempt to make sure that there's an accounting of what's done and that certain services are actually paid for. I'm not certain that this connects with the two issues that you raised.
Yeah.
Let me give you an example of what I'm thinking about. When the Eugene School Board set up a or affiliated with Eugene Education Fund, they were a contract, and the contract basically said we're going to give you so much money in terms of office space and assistance and things of that sort, and in return you're going to endeavor to raise X dollars or more for us on an annual basis. That was the agreement. It looks to me as though that probably complies with your 2 points, and I'm wondering if this does.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, I really haven't gotten into seeing kind of in detail how this would work. My understanding of what this would be a kind of an annual reporting back to some legislative committee on what they provided in terms of services, tickets, staff time, and then I believe there was supposed to be some reporting back on what they received in return,
right,
that, which would kind of lay that accountability out for public disclosure. And I think, like I said, fundraising is one of those different kind of animals where you're not sure if certain things that you do is going to pay off in the future. But if you do have a good process in place to set upfront what you're going to get and then kind of go back and review this, you can make changes in the future management-wise as opposed to, you know, kind of, you're not going to keep pouring money into the same organization if you're not getting anything back. And so, and then having this laid open for public disclosure, I think, would provide that for you.
Further questions? Representative Beckland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand your reference, Kathy, to the importance of accountability. I'm looking here at line 13 of the dash fives, actually starting at the end of line 12. The report must contain a detailed description of all tickets, promotional items, facilities, supplies, staff, and services. That's very compelling, it would seem to me, to those who are trying to raise money. Does that mean exactly what it is? That down to the last penny or down to the last piece of paper?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beckman, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know how this would be interpreted.
Yeah.
Just from an audit perspective, it has to be, we look at it as something that has to be functionally, you know, achievable. I mean, if you have it, I don't think what we're talking about here is having somebody that can will be punching their time clock, so if they go to run and get a card table for a booth, that they're going to have to punch a ticket and count 10 minutes of time. But if you have in advance an agreement set up with the organization that we are going to set up the booth and provide X hours of staff time to man the booth or whatever it is, and, you know, have those parameters set in advance, that's what we would be looking for if we went back to see that, and then kind of looking at the outcomes on the backside. So
you don't see that line at lines 12 and 13 as being too demanding or too specific or too narrow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Backlund, we would not audit down to this detail of a level, but we would be looking again, like I said, you know, did they have a process in place at the beginning? Something that's, you know, we're looking for reasonableness in what we're looking for. And not being a lawyer, but what a detailed description would be could be as much as, you know, provide assistance in setting up the booth. It wouldn't be down to, you know, how many people it took and how much time.
Further questions? Ms. Polino, to that end, too, can you describe, in, I guess, an audit function of de minimis activities? I mean, what when you're looking at compliance with this kind of, I guess, accounting, you know, some things that people do, I mean, if it's, you know, running off to set up a card table and it takes them 2 minutes or 5 minutes to do that, and here we're saying you have to charge for staffing. I mean, what would you look to see that they're charging for staffing to the foundation on de minimis activities like that?
It's a great question. I don't have a dollar amount for you, but just maybe looking back on state parks and what we were looking at, what they had when we looked at state parks in 1999 was a half-time staff person that devoted all their time to work on the foundation, and the state was paying for that time. And you know, what they did is they did get some advice from Department of Justice up front that said, you know, when you're beginning this kind of a trust and setting it up, it's okay to provide some staff time until the trust gets up on its feet and gets some money going. And then the trust should, once the trust is up and running, it should be able to provide its own staff and pay for the staff itself. And, you know, that was one of the things that we found is that we were 7-8 years into the trust's existence and they were still providing that staff time even though the trust had plenty of money to provide it themselves. In this case, it's a little bit different, though, because we're not talking about establishing a single trust to support the state fair. You're talking about different kinds of private nonprofits that will be providing help for the state fair. You know, again, my understanding of this is it's not going to be that much of the staff time. It's going to be, again, running to grab some card tables and help them set up and do some certain things. And it sounded like it were things that you could establish up front. You know, this is the agreement. This is what we are going to be providing for you, some general assistance, and then, you know, putting some kind of a reasonable price tag on what the value of that service would be. And that's really what we'd be looking for. And these are the kinds of things, too, that we would be going to Department of Justice to get some advice. You know, if we get down to some specifics or saw, you know, this one person spent 2 weeks on here, and it didn't appear that this was included in this contract. You know, we do go to justice to get some of those things hammered out, and how does that fit in with the specifics of the law? But again, we would be looking for major staff time, half-person time that isn't accounted for. You know, running to get a few things during the fair isn't... I wouldn't say I'd never give that up. I always reserve the right to question those, but we have other things to be looking for.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Further questions? Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Katie Cannon and Kathy Goss, we want to come forward as well. And Ms. Cannon, we received a note or a message that your board's okay with these amendments.
Chair Dorley, yes, we did talk to the founding foundation members, and they said that they could live with these.
Okay. And Ms. Goss, you're part of the fair board?
Fair commission, yes.
Fair commission. Mm-hmm. Any issues that you have with these amendments?
No. So we want to be accountable. We want to do the right thing and promote this and get it going.
Okay. Ms. Cannon, do you see any need to make any further changes to this on the Senate side? If we pass this out, are we going to be looking for a concurrence from the Senate, do you know, or non-concurrence?
Chair Doyle, I don't think I can answer for the Senate of how they would vote on this.
Okay. And you've had no discussions with them on that?
On these particular amendments, I do know that they have seen these, but I have not talked to the Senate President as far as how he feels about these.
Okay.
I mean, I haven't had that discussion with him.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Other questions? No? Representative Berger.
Yes. I just wonder if maybe I'm missing something here, because I can visualize the Seroptimus Club's wine festival, all the proceeds going to the state fair. The Zonta fashion show runs 2 days, makes thousands of dollars, usually goes to the Kidney Association. You happen to have someone that says, wouldn't you like to help the state fair, and it goes to the state fair. In those cases, you're not really providing free tickets or anything at all to promote that activity. You simply are receiving the proceeds. Am I missing something? Doesn't that fall under this particular bill? They're both nonprofits.
Chair Doyle, Representative Berger, let me make sure I understand your question. If you were saying that there are other nonprofits that may just want to donate something to the fair in general, yes.
Sure.
I mean, they can donate that. We're not necessarily, you know, even into an agreement with them. I mean,
no.
They could just, because the fair can accept donations at this time, even without this bill.
Mm-hmm.
I think what this bill does, though, is allows the director to look at various nonprofits that may be interested in working cooperatively with the state fair in probably what I would say more major type projects. An example might be, and I'm just, you know, I haven't talked to them about it, but like the FFA Board of Trustees, they may, or Alumni Association, they may want to build a new FFA pavilion, something like that. So this allows me to enter into an agreement, and I agree with Kathy Polino that it's important to have written agreements so they understand what they're providing and we understand what we're providing. But that's what this bill does. I mean, anything else smaller, I mean, we can accept donations now. But in all honesty, when you start getting donations on a regular basis, people don't want to give to a state agency where they will give to a foundation, and the foundation bundles that money up and then looks for a project that they want to support.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Okay. Oh. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Are you preparing us to vote on?
We can move the dash fives now, and then we can. I think what we'll do is wait for Legislative Council to come in with the emergency clause issue, and we can
wait until then.
Take that up another time, or we can. Well, I just assume let's pass the dash fives now.
Well, I did have a comment.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the, I don't know, maybe the benefit of the committee,
after the 1999 session, well, during the 1999 session, the legislature made a commitment to step in and really, let's say, make a commitment to help the Oregon State Fair. We sold, I think, $10 million at the bonds. We made and did a number of things along that line, and I was a member of the task force in each of the interims, and I've seen the state fair improve greatly and consistently, and so I like the idea, obviously, of what the Senate Bill 7 would do, and I'm certainly hopeful that this amendment will be beneficial. I've had a little bit of reservation. I think in some ways I prefer the original, but I understand what Kathy is saying, the auditor. But I just wanted to put on record that I'm very hopeful this is successful and that it's not restrictive or a problem in terms of being able to be as effective as the fundraising arm would like to be. So for whatever that's worth, I wanted to toss it out there.
Okay. You want to, Representative Flores? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've been rereading this thing while we've been talking about it, and it strikes me, and I think we've heard this in the testimony, that this sentence in subsection 5 may be overly restrictive and overly detailed. I think we heard the audit person tell us that they would not get down to this detail in an audit. In lines 12 through 16, I guess it is. I also wonder a little bit about putting in statute a requirement that the director be reimbursed for supplies, staff, and services. I mean, I'd be a lot more comfortable if what this amendment said were it was that if the director was going to provide tickets, promotional items, facilities, staff, or supplies and services, the things that are in the original bill, then they would have to have a contract with the foundation that would clarify. That would require an expectation of return on the part of the fair, and then expect that the normal audit, that the normal processes that normally would go into record keeping, so that they could be available for audit, would apply, rather than some very detailed material contained in a statute, which is a lot harder to fix if it turns out to be too cumbersome. I mean, I think it's very important that we get reports back about how it goes, which is why I'm perfectly happy with the first sentence of sub 5. The director shall submit an annual report to the legislature. But this other part, I'm wondering if it isn't simply too detailed and too demanding, and maybe even costly in terms of keeping track of these records. That's only a comment. I mean, I'm perfectly happy to pass the bill with that if that's the committee's pleasure.
Further discussion. Okay, Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 7 be adopted.
Representative Flores has moved adoption of the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 5. Discussion. Any objection?
For the reasons that I indicated.
And oh. I would.
Okay, let's call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
What's aye?
Aye.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
And chair votes aye. And dash fives are adopted to Senate Bill 7. And we will hold off then and close the work session on Senate Bill 7 and await the emergency clause issue. Let's see. Where am I? And now we can open up a public hearing on House Bill 3638. and ask Patrick Brennan to come forward as the administrator. And ask our state representatives, Butler, Mabry, and Garrard, to come forward. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Tom Butler from House District 60. Over in public safety, we just passed out a portion of the OIA budget, and they asked me if I would start wearing my hat backwards. But I told them I wouldn't until we can get an OIA budget that restores those beds back to the Oregon Youth Authority in rural Oregon. It's going to be important to make sure we make a statement. With regard to House Bill 3638, we're former county commissioners at this table this morning, and this afternoon. I just wondered if the length of my belt isn't about as tall as Representative Garrard is. But that was a bet between Representative Mabry and myself. So, as former county commissioners, I think you understand, we understand certainly, that the counties represent the workhorse of the delivery of many state agencies in these services. Particularly with regard to community corrections, mental health, public health, addiction services, veteran services, and many others. We've reduced the funding for these programs over the 5 special sessions and then the 6 special sessions we held during the regular session this year. And counties certainly know that state funds are going to be reduced even further this session by the end of the time we finish up. As these reductions, as we go through the cycles, this will likely happen again sometime in the future as well. Now, if we want to maintain counties whole and intact to deliver these valuable services to us in the future and in tough times, then we really have a duty and obligation to them to give them the legislative protection against liability claims when they have to scale back services in response to our funding reductions in the state. Consequently, I ask that the House Bill 3638 should provide the standard kinds of language to provide our contractual relationship and contractual friends and associates in service delivery, but to be legislated and given these opportunities for the county to be somewhat protected. And I want to urge the committee to report this bill to the Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation, providing that little bit of support that's needed to protect our county partners in the delivery in tough times. Thank you very much.
Representative Gard?
I was going to let age dictate, let Representative Mabry go next, but just to echo Representative Butler's remarks, I'm sure the budget reductions that we're all looking at brought to light a variety of gaps to be filled in how we, the state, conduct business in a partnership with our counties. As a former county commissioner, there were times when we honestly did not know where the county stood in that relationship. This bill helps, I believe, professionalize it so that we counties will know what their liabilities and procedures are. I believe this is a straightforward bill that will bring balance to the partnership. It provides the mechanics for how counties can scale back services when state general fund money is reduced. It provides some legislative flexibility for the agencies to work with counties in the process. And finally, it provides consistency in approach across these programs. So, again, I urge the passage of 3638. Representative
Mabry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My remarks will be brief as promised. I guess I look at this as a fairness issue. If I contract with my next-door neighbor boy to mow my lawn every week and partway through the contract year, I tell him I'm going to reduce his pay by a certain amount, I think it's appropriate for him to say, "Oh, okay, but then I don't think I'm going to edge and trim for that reduced rate." And I think counties find themselves in that same contractual basis. They want to provide the services that they've contracted for, but oftentimes agreements are written, for example, I'm making this up because I don't know for sure what it is, but if the contract with the state says counties will supervise all convicted persons upon release onto probation, and then they're obligated to that level, and the funding is shorted, then perhaps it's appropriate for the counties to say, okay, we're not going to be able to supervise misdemeanors have not done just property crimes or something like that because of the reduction of manpower that we have. I think that's appropriate, but if the language is written that they'll supervise them all, the liability is there for the counties to supervise them all. And so I think it's just appropriate for us to recognize that and continue a partnership agreement as opposed to, you know, someone that says, you know, this is the contract, this is the agreement, you will comply with it or else.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My greatest concern about this is if it could have huge implications regarding the health and safety of our population. And I'm looking at public health primarily. What if we have a major bioterrorist attack on our water system, or there's a disease, et cetera, that hits us? And the county then says, sorry, we just don't have the money. I think it's our obligation to rally the forces, get the hospitals involved, get, you know, I mean, there's such huge implications rather than the county saying, I just don't have the funds, because I do feel that there's a mission here, and part of the mission of public health is to provide health and safety. And so I have a real concern about the real implications of what this bill could possibly mean.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lawrence Anderson, I share that concern with you, and certainly we recognize that when we turn over certain responsibilities from the state to the county to take care of certain issues, that the counties have the funding that goes with that additional liability and responsibility. And I would think that if, in fact, there was there began to be terrorist attacks on our water reservoirs, on our other communities, and some of those issues, that certainly to the extent that those responsibilities are number one state responsibilities to protect all communities in the state from these kinds of terrorist actions, those communities could band together and come back to the legislature and the emergency board and ask for the additional resources to be able to protect and to meet those obligations. The kinds of obligations that we are in fact talking about are first state obligations that we join together in partnership with the delivery of those functions as being a local obligation, and in the past we've provided the resource for them. What we're concerned about from the and the direction of 3638 is if the state has a responsibility and joins in a bilateral arrangement, a bilateral contractual arrangement with the counties, and then because of short funding, the state is unable to then provide the funding and cuts back by 50%. In the past, the counties have done everything that they could, including the exhausting of their own general funds, but they don't have any further ability than the state does to generate those funds. Our concern at that point is that the counties not be held liable for their inability to complete the job when we are not paying for the job to be done. Rather than making, as Representative Mabry indicates, rather than all of a sudden making a unilateral contract where the state says, we just don't have enough money to pay you to go ahead and provide for those bioterrorist attacks, but we still want the job done, then at that particular point, what we're asking is that the county have some indemnification for its inability to perform those functions.
Just follow up. And I understand what you're saying, but I do think that the counties then will have to relook at their mission statements, so to speak, and say, depending on money, our goal will be to provide for the health and safety of the population. And I just, it's hard for me to buy that.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond. Actually, I don't think you have ever, nor do I think you ever will, see a county make that kind of unilateral adjustment. And as a county that suffered bioterrorism attack during the Rajneesh times, they attacked our salad bars, but the intent was after that trial run to attack our water reservoirs. And we responded, and we would continue to respond. The point is that there is some liability that has been handed down to counties because of tasks that we've taken over at the request of the state, and if the money doesn't come with those, we just want to be relieved of the liability if we haven't been able to meet the standard that we would like as a county. So I just think it's you're never going to see the counties back away from any of those responsibilities. In fact, the counties would have never taken on those responsibilities if they weren't important to counties to complete anyway.
Okay. Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to ask Representative Butler if he might be willing to give me his magic hat, because Linn County has not been able to get their Oregon Youth Authority beds restored.
I would say Representative Close is very, very brave if she wants to put on Representative Butler's hat.
I agree.
All right, further questions? All right, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, Representative Barnhart?
This may be the wrong panel to ask it of. I've got two different amendments in my file, the dash ones and the dash twos.
I'm the wrong panelist.
Okay, I'll wait.
Okay. Okay, Bob Cantine, why don't you come forward? Do you have anybody else to join you in a presentation of the bill? And colleagues, as Mr. Cantine presents the bill, the issues of amendments, I would think he would be the one to answer those questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Cantine with the Association of Oregon Counties, here to speak in favor of House Bill 3638. Correct, there are two sets of amendments, but the dash two amendments incorporate all of the dash one. So we're really dealing with the dash two amendment. As the previous speakers indicated, the issue here that's raised in House Bill 3638 came about as the counties began to come to grips with what are they going to do, how are they going to respond as their funding for the service they contract to provide for the state starts diminishing. How do we deal with that? And there are a number of programs where that happens. I think the total that I added up for the special sessions was about $60+ million that was taken back during those five special sessions, and that went across community corrections, public mental health, alcohol and drug, a variety of programs, Oregon Health Plan, and they ended up totaling over $60 million. So that started the conversation. There are a number of counties, and community corrections, I guess, was at the center of it when the conversation started, who do not want to turn that program back. They feel it's worked well. They find that the community is safer when they're doing it. They've lived through the times when the state used to try and supervise these post-prison parole and probation people, and they feel they get a better service and do a better job keeping them from reoffending by doing it locally. So the problem they had to address is how do they take on these reductions, and what do we do about them? So we tried to craft a bill that addressed that in five areas, really: community corrections, mental health, public health, juvenile crime prevention planning, and children and families commission responsibility. And we're trying to deal with the need for reduced service expectations by the public when there is reduced state general funds. And this is limited to state general funds. That's all we're talking about here. So I'm going to go over how the bill is designed just a minute to accomplish this goal, and what I say encompasses the dash two amendments. In other words, I won't deal with them separately, but I can come back and do that later. First, the bill makes it clear that the state grants the immunity from liability, the same immunity that the state agency had. They, as they reduce service, they extend that same immunity to the county when they reduce service as their funds are reduced from the state. And that's accomplished through the phrase subject to the availability of general funds. That's how that immunity is transferred to us from you statutorily. And that's why you see that phrase in there several times. Then the question came up, all right, now that we've got that, how do we implement the reduction? How do we do that? What's the mechanics of getting there? And we originally had just one method. I will tell you that we've held meetings with quite a few of the agencies, almost all of them, to talk to them about the issues they would have. And we had to go back and make amendments to address their concerns, and that's what the dash ones and dash twos were about. We were trying to respond to their issues that they had. So we set out two procedures. And I think you would recognize these because they're sort of the same thing that you do here at the state level and discussions you've had. The first one, sort of the default procedure, is that you reduce proportionally. The county just, if they need to, if they can't backfill, then they would do proportional reduction. The second one provides a mechanism for the agency and the county to sort of renegotiate the contract and find a better way to use that money. If there's a, to make it more effective, to target it, to do something different with what's left after the cuts are made. In neither case does the county have any option to select a specific service and not provide that service. It has to have the joint concurrence of the state, unless all they're doing is just reducing proportionally. Otherwise, you have to have a contract change, and it has to be with the agreement of the state. Then we also had to address the issue of civil commitment funding. Civil commitment is sort of an anomaly in the statute in that, unlike the rest of the mental health piece, what it says is we will provide that service, which includes crisis services, and the state will provide the funding, but then it adds a sentence. But if the state money runs out, then we will provide the funding. So that in effect the county backfills the state in those situations. And what we do provide is to try and make it the same as the rest of the mental health arrangement. And if the money runs out, then the county will adjust the crisis services and civil commitment process, and then the state will have that option at that point from the funds that they have for mental health to prioritize. And if civil commitment is the most important use of the fund, then they can shift within their money and get that either back down to us or make the payments direct. But they're the ones that have the budget here that has the mental health funding and all the components of it, and they're the ones that would prioritize. And I assume they would come back and do it like they would a rebalance. It would be part of their rebound. Finally, the bill evens up the opt-out notice requirement. There's three of the programs that we can, that the county is authorized to turn back to the state if they feel they cannot handle the program. And all we did there was try to provide the same notice requirement so that, you know, it's 180 days in community corrections. There was not a statutory time frame for notice in mental health or public health. And then we extended it to Children and Families Commission so that in all of those programs, there is the ability of the county, if they wish to relinquish it back to the state, to relinquish it to the state. And then the state, as your current laws read, and then we make one addition here for children and families, they then proceed to either find another agency or a private nonprofit. So that's how we tried to address the opt-out provision. And finally, the bill originally had an amendment, a provision in there that said that the state would defend in the case of a lawsuit against the county for failure to provide service. And that has been removed from the bill, and we will defend ourselves. People, state officials simply didn't want to manage that risk, so we will manage it, and that's been dropped from the bill. So, as I've tried to indicate, we're trying to find a constructive midpoint here. How do you encourage counties to stay in, but give them protection when they stay in? And we hope that we found a way to do that. As I said, we visited with the agencies. I know you're going to hear from them. There's still problems. We had a discussion the other day with the governor's office. They've agreed to get all the parties together again and sit down at one table and see if there are things that still need to be worked out. And we're willing to do that. But I would want to do it under some timeline that is your desire so that we can process the bill and get it moving, because we do need to address some of these issues. And so I would encourage you to give serious consideration to the bill itself, but also understand our willingness to sit down and work some more if that's what your desire. And I'd be glad to answer questions.
Thank you. Representative Close?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Bob, I just wanted to clarify on the opt-out. Did you say it's going to be across the board 180 days for all three?
Yes. Madam Vice Chair and Representative Close, yeah, what we did, we heard also from the agencies that, well, in the contracts, we may have some different time frames in there, and so what we did was make it 180 days unless otherwise provided by contract. So we added that phrase in.
Follow up. So it's about a half a year, and it seems like a long time, other than if we, and I'm wondering how it will work into the biennium, you know, flipping over in July. Did you talk about that at all?
Well, I can tell you it is sort of an awkward situation, for example, with community corrections. If you have to give 180 days notice and you don't know quite where the state is on the budget, there are some that had to go ahead and give notice because they had no idea where things would end up. And it crosses over the July 1 fiscal year period of the state. So you just have to do the best you can. If you have special sessions, then we can see what's going on, and we have a better opportunity then to know where we're positioned. And I think that would be the only way in which the money would be reduced. You would have to act first, so we would see a special session and then see if we could live with that, and then in effect it probably would cause a county to absorb some of that cost until 180 days ran out.
Okay.
That's good.
Thank you.
Representative Lana Sanderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to set up a scenario, and you tell me how you think this could be resolved. We have a county commissioners, say three, that really don't like public health, don't like that department at all, and money's cut, and their preference would be for the money to go into corrections, all into corrections preferably. Is it conceivable under this that their priorities are such that they basically minimize everything to public health and redirect the money then to corrections? And I know you say there has to be an agreement with the state and the county, but there is no resolution. So that's one scenario. Then what do you do when there is no resolution between the state and the county?
We'll go back. First, make sure that you understand that we're talking only about the state general fund. This is changes that the county would make in adjusting to reduction to the state general fund money. Now, they cannot take state general fund money and move it from public health to community correction. I'm trying to think of how they might ever get to what you're talking about. If the money was reduced in public health from the state, the county could make the choice, which they already can. I mean, it's, they already have the right to relinquish it back to you. So that, there's no change in that in the statute. They could do that and then free up whatever money they're putting in there and go put it in community corrections. But it would be their own money. It would not be the state money. There's no way that I can see that,
well,
that they could move the state money.
Clarification. Let's go where the pots of money come from, the same source. And again, I don't...
Okay. No,
let's still stick with public health and then with the money flowing through for the Commission of Children and Families. And so their commissioners really supported Healthy Start and that piece, wanted to fund that and then get rid of the whatever else the general fund would support. For instance, I'm not sure if much general fund goes into communicable disease, but immunizations would be one. So,
Madam Chair and Representative Mona Sanderson, the way in which this would work, if the funding that went into public health was reduced, the county would have two options. They could either reduce all of the five mandated services for which the state general fund money was intended, and it is being reduced, or they could, if they were interested, go to the state agency and say, would you want to come together and talk with us to see if there's a better way for us to spend what's left among those five programs that are part of public health. That's as far as I can see they can go. There's no way for them to try and then move something over to Children and Families Committee. This does not do that. Madam Chair, if I could also respond earlier to the concern you had about bioterrorism and public health. Currently, and I guess what I want to say is we're asking that you grant to us the same immunity that you give, that you have yourself, and that you give to your state agency. There's nothing in excess of that. And so the question about our behavior with reductions in public health or bioterrorism, if we have a terrorism accident, is the same question you would have to ask of your own agencies, because we're not going beyond the same kind of protection that you give to them, which is called discretionary immunity. And they are not obligated to carry out a program if you don't give them the money. So we're not treating ourselves differently than you treat your own state agency. Our problem is that we are not acting as governing bodies in the relationship of being a provider when we're contracting with you. And when we're doing just our own things, when we're only dealing with our own budgets at the county level and the board is making the decisions to put money here and not put money here, just like you do with the legislature, we have discretionary immunity. Because that's legislative discretion, and you have it. The problem is, what do we have when we're in this contract provider relationship? And that's where we're having a struggle, trying to figure out how to deal with that. I'm just telling you straight, that's where we're coming from. That's what our problem is. There's no hidden agenda in this discussion. It is what we're trying to get at.
Representative Farnheit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really have two questions, and I'm trying to put the bill in context, and that's the reason for these questions. To what extent does this issue relate to the constitutional unfunded mandates issue, if at all?
Madam Vice Chair and Representative Barnhart, it only does in one indirect way. And that is with civil commitment funding. That one is a fund. That was a mandate that predated Measure 30, which was enacted, I believe, in 96 or 97. It predates that. It's an existing servant. However, when there's a provision in Measure 30 which said that an existing service is exempt from the unfunded mandates law unless the legislature withdraws funding for that service below the level that it was funding in 1997. And if it does that, then the service becomes voluntary. And this is the case, best we can tell right now, with crisis services and civil commitment. So the counties are continuing to do it. They're just doing it voluntarily, even though there's no money coming from the state. We also have a case in which a county has said, I can't do it, and the state essentially waived the requirement. Says, okay, you don't have to do civil commitments anymore by contract.
Follow up on this point. So to summarize, it's your view that the unfunded mandate requirement of Measure 30 now applies to all of the services that we're talking about in this bill. That is, if we don't fund it, the services are being provided on a voluntary basis by the counties. The counties can't be required to provide those services because of Measure 30.
Madam Chair, and Representative Barnhart.
On an unfunded basis.
Yes, and but there's one other little factor that comes into play here. In these services, we have the ability to opt out. You've given us that ability, so that almost makes Measure 30 moot. The one case where it is not there is in the civil commitment, and that's why I've referenced civil commitment.
I see, and if I could follow up, but your view is even in that area, that because funding has fallen below the levels that are of the date you indicated, and I forget what date.
Yeah, I believe it's 1997, the date of the Act.
The date of the Act.
Yeah.
The funding is below that level now, and therefore the Act itself triggers this falling under the unfunded mandate section.
That's correct.
Okay. A different topic, if I could. I'm still confused about why we need this I understand the issue about immunity, I think. But I don't understand why this can't be covered simply in the contract language that when you enter into contracts with the state to provide these services in the first place. Would you describe why this statute is necessary rather than simply making sure that you, in every contract you have, that you include language that says if you don't fund us at the level we've agreed to, we're going to make these kinds of reductions and we're going to do it in that manner, and why that doesn't cover you for liability issues purposes?
Two answers, Madam Chair, Madam Vice Chair, Representative Barnhart. Two answers. The first one is that discretionary immunity, my understanding, cannot be given or granted to us by a state agency. It has to be given to us by the legislature. And so we have to do it by including the clause that says subject to available funds. That is how you get at that. The agency is not empowered to transfer that authority unless it's in the statute to us. That's the main reason.
So, to follow, to simplify, I mean, to summarize the answer, I think what you're telling us is that the legislature, through by law, has the right to make that delegation.
That's right.
But an agency doesn't.
That's right.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion. Representative Monsanto.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if I understand that. And I take into account contract that we would have with an HIV program. Say Clackamas County has an HIV program, enters into contract with Multnomah County, say, for HIV. Always it seemed like boilerplate language was depending on funding that comes through. I think that's part of boilerplate contracts, but where there's no way we're going to provide a public health nurse for this program if we don't get money. So we've written into that we have to definitely have the money before we provide the service.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lewis Anderson, again, it's my understanding, and I can have our special counsel address it too if you would like to do it further, but there's a statutory obligation on the county to deliver the service. The only way that can be limited is by the legislature if we are going to seek if we're going to protect ourselves in a claim against us that we failed to fulfill the obligation that the legislature imposed on us. And the remedy is to have you give us that flexibility that your state agencies have. When they're taken to court on the issue, it's very hard for the complaining party to win because you will make a claim of discretionary immunity in that case, that if we don't have the money, we're not going to provide the service. This case, we need that to come from you somewhere, and it comes through a legislative act.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Cantine. You know that I am in sympathy with what you're trying to accomplish here, and I want to ask you a couple of questions for clarification. You've indicated that counties already have the right to relinquish responsibilities for certain programs back to the state. Would that happen in an arbitrary manner as far as, oh, we don't care to provide mental health services, therefore that has to go back to the state, or we don't care to provide services to children, therefore that has to go back to the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, the statutes currently do not provide any limitation on that decision. The only case that there's a limitation on is in community correction. And community corrections is only in the event that the state fails to fulfill its funding obligation, which is spelled out to be current service level and some other things, then that triggers the opt-out. And the others, that kind of trigger is not in there. My experience in the limited time I've been here, which is about 12 years, was that the tendency is, if it's that kind of a concern, that generally what happens is the county itself will transfer it to a district. There's a health district option. Columbia County is a good example. Or they will tend to go to a private nonprofit. Mental health, in particular, has moved toward a private nonprofit model in about a third of the counties. So that, and it's driven sometimes internally by the director and by budget decision, because they feel that there's more flexibility to be separate from the county government, and that they can get more grants and foundation money and things. So a lot of times they will do that. But it's in about one-third of the cases. The county, though, has retained the mental health authority. They haven't given the authority back to the state. They've retained the authority, and then the operation has been put in a private nonprofit.
Thank you. Follow up. Then, if I understand you correctly, it is not the position that you are advocating for the counties to rid yourself of any service to any component.
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, no, that is not the case. We're trying to establish the conditions that will be conducive to them staying in.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Burgess.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cantine, let me kind of understand that last question, because I'm getting the sense that the county is doing programs because they are actually accommodating the state of Oregon by contract. Let's say that those programs were not there and the state didn't ask you to do anything. there is a certain responsibility of local government to provide for the people within their municipality or within their county. So regardless of the position of the state, I'd like to turn this around a little bit, and that is that there is some responsibility of the county to provide some services. Now, you might take out corrections if it is indeed state probation and parole, but eliminating that, would you agree that mental health services, public health, Commission on Children and Families are services that counties do for citizens that has some benefit to your county, irregardless of the position of the state of Oregon?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, let me answer it in this way. Yes, counties do a great deal in public health. They've done historically mental health functions. I would say yes to community corrections. Community corrections was a accommodation to the state. Very clearly, we did not perform those functions at all. We did have a option 1, 2, and 3 at that time, where a county could choose whether they wanted to do it or not, and some did. But it was quite different. This is a mandate with an opt-out provision now, and changed the nature of Children and Families was clearly a state-initiated program that I don't know that we would have performed it the same way. We would still be interested and do things that are related to understanding the social needs of the community. Yes, I agree with that. We might not have done it in a manner that was mandated by a bill that created Children and Families Commission. So, yes, we would do some of the functions. We might not accommodate it in the same way that you've designed it and required us to do that. Public health, we are probably the dominant player in the public health field, and we'll continue to do that, although there have been some cases where the county has gotten so poor that they had to, and in a nearby county of yours, Curry County, where they literally just felt they didn't have the money to do the department anymore. They were out. And so in that case, they initiated discussions about relinquishing the authority. And that's why the state has that provision in there, so that there is that safety valve if that happens. But yeah, they will be doing public health, community health, environmental health, lots of things, Oregon Health Plan. But what this is trying to, it's not trying to encourage opt-out, it's trying to avoid it by setting up the conditions so that you have a way to deal with budget reduction. That's what we're trying to do.
Okay, further questions? All right, thank you, sir. Mickey Lansing. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mickey Lansing. I am the Deputy Director of the Oregon Commission on Children and Families. We're here today to speak to House Bill 3638 with several concerns. Concern number one is that neither the State Commission on Children and Families nor local commissions on children and families provide direct services. In fact, we are prohibited from doing so by the legislation. The dollars that come through the commission system come to local commissions. Local commissions decide locally how they want to spend those dollars based upon strategic investments according to their local coordinated comprehensive plan. We are a bit different than other state entities. We were meant to be created outside of that human service delivery system because our role was to engage the local community to be able to look at what the delivery system actually looks like and to support the services of mental health, public health, alcohol and drug, all of those things that are provided locally. As it is now, we leverage the dollar that goes to local commissions, leverages $28 million at least a year in local funding. And that does not include other public funds. That includes private funds. So our role in the commission system was to send those dollars locally, have local citizens make decisions about where they believe those dollars needed to be invested. Those dollars are not in a direct service provision by the county. However, the county's role is to oversee the implementation of those local coordinated comprehensive plans. So we believe that we are not covered, should not be covered in this legislation. Our second concern is that in our particular statute, we do have waivers already that if, in fact, the county had a hardship in terms of funding that was available to them, all they need to do is to submit a waiver to us, and we would act upon that waiver. I want you to know that this past legislative session, as we started to look at the budget for the commission system for 03-05, Senator Jackie Winters convened a legislative work group made up of six counties, small, medium, and large, made up of our court-appointed special advocate folks, our crisis relief nursery folks, and we said to them, if we have to take reductions, could we, within our system, make recommendations to you about where those reductions would be? That work group worked four different days, and we came out with 10, 20, and 30% reductions for our particular budget. When the dollars are sent to local communities in the commission system, they are not sent directly to the county for the county to provide services. I just want to go back to that point. They are, even though they become county dollars, the local commissions contract those dollars out to providers in the community. They do not provide direct services. So if the dollars are reduced, then they know they only have a certain amount of funding that they're able to contract out with the local providers. And every contract says based upon available funding. I do want you to know that when the commission system was created in 1993 by then Speaker of the House Larry Campbell, the Board of County Commissioners at that time came in and said, we want to have this particular system under our jurisdiction. That's why the governance structure was set up as it was when we were created. That's all I have to say. I would be glad to answer any questions.
Sorry, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like you to be a bit more explicit, if you can, about the way this bill, or the problems you see in this bill in terms of its interaction with the program that you have in place. I mean, let me give you an example of a question that you might answer. Is it your interpretation of this bill that it would allow the counties to reach down through the local commission and change the funding priorities that the local commission had determined, or is it something else? Or do you have some other concern about this bill? So far, I don't know what the concern specifically is.
Okay. Yes. Chair Flores and Representative Barnhart. Our concern is that it says, where it says in on line 6 in the dash 2 amendments, page 1. In cases where money is available to a county from the general fund for the provision of services by a regional commission or a local commission on children and families are reduced, and in lieu of discontinuing operation of the regional or local commission, provide reduced services in direct proportion to the amount that money is available from the general fund are reduced. And it's our belief that the local comprehensive plan needs to direct where those dollars go, so that in fact counties aren't able to say, well, if we have to reduce over here, maybe we'll take some funds from the local commission and then backfill over here. In fact, we would prefer to look at an opt-out agreement at some particular point in time if the county does not believe they can provide or oversee the provision of those services. But the local comprehensive plan, through the local commission and their partners, is what directs where those particular services go and where those dollars go in terms of providing the services. Is that...
Well, that's helpful.
Okay.
So this amendment would provide a different method for determining the distribution of the funds. I don't see anything here that would allow the county to take money out of regional commission or local commission services unless the funds available from the state, from the general fund for that, was reduced. Do you think that this gives to the county the right to take funds out of this area and put it somewhere else?
Chair Ford, is Representative Barnhart. I think that possibility is there, but we don't believe we need to be here in the first place in terms of this particular legislation, because if you look at the legislation, it speaks specifically to those programs that are provided directly by the counties, like mental health, alcohol and drug, etc. The local commissions are not direct service providers, so they only get the amount of money that has been allocated to them by the legislative body. And so once those funds come, then those funds are contracted out to local providers based upon what the priorities are in their local coordinated comprehensive plan.
Okay, let me follow up again. I'm sorry to take so much time, but I'm still having trouble making sense of the concern. So if you had a budget for X amount, and the legislature comes along because there's a reduction in the funds we have coming in, and say, sorry, you're not going to get X amount, you're going to get X minus Y, then you've already allocated X out to your system. The local commission has already done that because that was what the budget was. Now we're telling them you're not going to get that much money. What are the provisions that you currently have for how you would reduce the funds available to the providers, and how does this interfere with that?
Chair Flores, Representative Barnhart, currently every provider in every county in their contract with the local commission has a provision that says based upon available funding. So if the funding were reduced, then they would automatically have to revise that particular contract. That would be done locally with the provider, not with the county.
Okay. Last question, and I'm done with this subject, I hope. Do you have, is there a way of repairing this so that it removes your objection through some other mechanism for this particular program? Because what we've been told up to now is that we need something in the statute to allow for a discretionary, I forget what the word was, allow for discretion so to avoid liability. And that's what this attempt is. They've also told us that you can't do it just by the contract. Is there language we could put in the statute instead for the purposes of your agency that would accomplish the same purpose without doing violence to the local plans? And if so, can you provide it for us?
Chair Flores, Representative Barnhart, in answer to that question, we already have language in our statute that lets them be able to opt out. They can get a waiver. It's called a hardship waiver, and I would be glad to provide that to you, what that language is. The other thing is that we would be more than happy to work with AOC. In fact, we would like to be able to work with them on an opt-out clause. So if, in fact, a county said, we no longer want to have this particular initiative in our community, we'd like to give it back to you. We would like to have them give it back to us in whole, rather than parceling, making a decision to parcel out particular services. And then we will recontract with a local community-based organization, a neighboring county. We'd still have a local commission on children and families, still provide the same kind of efforts, but it just would not be overseen by that particular county.
I think I'm done with the questions. There is a bunch of policy questions, but I think I now understand what you're pointing.
Thank you.
Representative Berger. Let's see if I can come up with an example. Baloney Boys Ranch is still within your jurisdiction. It's reduced. The comprehensive plan shows that you're going to have to reduce something. As a matter of the reduction to the boys' ranch, a boy escapes from the ranch, leaves. Of course, I think he can leave now, but leaves and is run over on the highway. A lawsuit comes against the Commission on Children and Families for the reduction of the money that went to the boys' ranch. Does that then go to the county? Does that liability stay with the county as a county program?
Chair Flores, Representative Verger, not being an attorney, I'm not sure that I can answer that question. However, the program itself would have liability, I believe, at the county level. But I would like to get back to you on that before I said that for sure.
Follow up. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just trying to help clarify for Representative Barnhart a scenario that is coming. I can see where you actually feel, because you don't provide direct services, why this bill might not, should not have the commission in it. On the other hand, I think what I'm trying to follow up is the liability issue, which is what is concern of AOC.
Right. Just to follow up on that comment, I agree that that's, those are the issues. The counties are trying to get out from under liability. They've proposed a plan whereby they can do that in terms of and a way of mitigation. And now what I think we're hearing is this method of mitigation doesn't work in the connection with this agency for the reasons stated. And I think I understand the point that's being raised. The question is can we do something about it for the purpose of this bill? That's the question for us to consider rather than the witness. But I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ms. Lansing, you heard Mr. Cantine testify his understanding that the governor's office was going to be calling all the interested parties together to dialogue over this and see if there could come to some resolution of everyone's concerns. And do I understand that you're going to be a willing participant in that discussion?
Chair Flores, yes, we will. In fact, we would welcome that opportunity. Our first interaction with the Association of Oregon Counties was last Thursday about this particular piece. And we are sympathetic to their plight. We just want you to know that we believe we are a little different because of the fact that we do not provide direct services, either at the state or the local level.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Thank you.
Well, I was just going to say that I hope that the counties and the commission will get together and work on this language to see if they can't come up with something that satisfies both.
And a number of other interested parties, as
right.
I understand.
Yeah.
Barry Cast and James Tews, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced that.
Madam Chair, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity. My name is Barry Cast. I'm Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services for Health Services, and with me is James Taves, who is the Assistant Director for Seniors Services to Seniors and People with Disabilities. And we're here to speak about some of the concerns that the Department of Human Services has, since we're involved in the provision of public health, mental health, alcohol and drug, and developmental disability services in the auspices of this bill. I wanted to say by way of background that before coming to the state in 1986, I worked for 11 years for Benton County, so I've been on both sides of this sometimes dysfunctional marriage. And I went through the 1981 recession where many of the same kinds of issues were expressed, and we were able in our relationship with the state at that time to negotiate a successful and transition through those troubled waters. We don't regard county government as simply a provider or a contractor, although certainly there are times when that is the functional dimension of this relationship. And indeed, I spent most of the morning at the meeting of the Conference of Local Health Officials, which is empowered by statute to make decisions in concert with the department as the expression of partnership between the state. In fact, we negotiate almost everything with the counties in mental health, in public health, alcohol and drug and developmental disability services. And we are, and have been for the past couple of months, working with county councils around issues of reciprocity that have been raised earlier. But this kind of relationship, this kind of partnership, is strained during times of financial stress. And I think our concern about the viability of county government is also well documented. The bill is sort of a signal that we are perhaps at a point below which we cannot move without a significant breakdown in that historical relationship. I don't think it's possible for us to ignore the value of the partnership aspect of this relationship between the state and the counties. Indeed, you have, in your legislation, empowered us and the counties to work together to integrate services, to make comprehensive plans possible. And one of our chief concerns about this bill is that in its implementation, if the logic of this bill were to be followed, we would see and we would anticipate significant deterioration in the comprehensiveness of services, the potential fragmentation of services, the lack of comprehensiveness of services that you have directed us to do in Senate Bill 555 and in the House Bill 3204 and 2294. These are bills which speak directly to the need for a locally directed human service system. And in fact, just for the purposes of the discussion today, county government is the integrating function in our human service system. There's very little that we do in terms of direct service in state government. Most of our services we provide are provided either by counties or under county direction and county local planning. So there are some risks related to the process here. Fragmentation of the service delivery system is one. And in almost every case, as Mr. Cantine has pointed out, the counties do have an option, a voluntary option for these services, and with the exception of certain mental health functions. And I can recall before Ways and Means asking, well, what is mandated in this system? Very little is mandated, but much is expected. And the great fear we have is that if this system were to break down and all of these services were returned to the state, or even a substantial portion of them, the costs and the challenges associated with assuring Oregonians that those services were available would be difficult to manage and to achieve. We would see perhaps a slow at first and then more rapid erosion of services element by element, increasing state operation, or as an alternative, a contracted service delivery system that was then separated from the local decision-making process and the local planning process. There is one difficult riddle in the middle of this statute, because it, or this bill, because it does not relieve or remove from county government some of its authorities under the law. For example, it's the local public health authority or the local mental health authority. And I could anticipate a time when we were in an awkward situation in which county government in its role as an authority was directing the state as to which services to provide, and that would be turn the service system on its head in a very interesting way. So for those reasons, we are very concerned about the implications of the bill. And for that reason, as you've heard, the governor is interested in supporting county government and working constructively to find a solution in that direction. And we would anticipate doing so, as we have been doing with our community contracts. Mr. Tace has some comments about the specific language of the bill and certain financial provisions.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, James Taves from the Senior and Disability Program within the Department of Human Services. And just to echo Barry, that our concern should not be construed in any way to diminish our value of this partnership. I mean, we truly believe in this partnership, and we want to do everything possible to make it work and to continue. The original bill talked about the state sort of defending or indemnifying a county against liabilities or claims that would arise out of insufficient services caused by funding reductions and things of that sort, and that's pretty much taken out in the Dash 2 amendments. But as Mr. Cantine talked about, in the Dash 2 amendments, it then talks about how the county, as a option, as opposed to giving the entire program back, could start to make reductions in the program proportionate to what the general fund reductions had been. Unfortunately, or I shouldn't say unfortunately, most of the general fund dollars of the Department of Human Services are involved in federal match programs, and to a significant degree, the general fund dollars are tied up with our federal Medicaid program. That federal Medicaid program requires us to provide statewideness, uniform services, benefits, eligibility in any area or corner of the state. And we can't have sort of discretionary cuts or changes or different priorities for different programs in select areas. So even though it talks about a proportionate reduction, proportionate to the general fund reduction, if some counties were doing that and other counties were not doing that, you would very quickly tip over the balance and have a very unequal Medicaid program across the state. Secondly, when we make significant general fund reductions, as we have in the past six months to a year, every one of those changes had to be negotiated with the federal government. We have gone on the health plan, and particularly in developmental disabilities and in our Medicaid program, our senior and disability programs, we have been in protracted negotiations, and all those reductions had to be negotiated in changes to our Medicaid, our home and community-based waiver. And at every level, we've attempted to include our local partners in those discussions and translating how those reductions might roll out in accordance with the federal guidelines as well. So it's been a very complicated process. It's been exhausting for us. It's been exhausting for our local government partners. But a formula that works proportionately in this way on a discretionary basis by individual counties, I think, would run afoul of federal Medicaid law very, very quickly. Under federal law, the Department of Human Services is the single state Medicaid agency. And that doesn't diminish our partnership with local government, but it means that our local government partners and our subcontractors have to be in compliance with those statewide single Medicaid sets of regulations. So we understand what local government's trying to do here. We acknowledge the concern, and we will continue to meet with county councils, and you've heard the offer from the governor's office, but we don't think the bill will get us to where it needs to go. I should say parenthetically, I don't think it proves the point either way. Right now we have over a dozen major lawsuits pending against the Department of Human Services based on all of the different reductions. to my knowledge, they have not named at this point in time local government in any of those lawsuits. Again, I don't think it proves the point, but I think at least at this point, most of the liability for the big general fund reductions have still rested on state government and on the department at this point in time. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. It sounds like you're saying that the counties really don't have discretion in dealing in this area, that this has to be a statewide system.
Madam Vice Chair, Representative Barnhart, it depends on the program, because again, we're talking about many different programs that the department operates with or through local government, and different parts of those programs are part of the Medicaid program. Different parts are governed by different federal statutes, so I wouldn't say that uniformly. What I would say as a general principle, though, is the vast majority of our general funds are tied to federal match, and as such, whatever the formulas and plan requirements at the federal level apply, we have to apply those at both the state and the local level as well. So in that sense, you are correct. There isn't a tremendous amount of discretion at the local level, except as part of negotiations with us and in turn with our federal partners on those program changes.
Madam Chair, I can comment, Representative Barnhart, that local discretion increases as general fund becomes the unique source of funding. And unfortunately, in the process of reducing the budget over the past year, we've tried to preserve those programs in which there was matching federal funds. So the places that have been cut most severely, community crisis services and mental health, for example, communicable disease, per capita allocations to the counties, and public health, those are areas that have been compromised and I think are the subject of greatest concern by our partners. And in those areas, for the most part, the communities do have some considerable flexibility about how to make those services work. We've tried to preserve that flexibility in the past in working with you around statute and in our contracts. So there is some ability to move funds. But when they're as low in allocations as they are today, I think the concern becomes much greater in those general funded services.
One more, and then I promise I'm done with this panel.
Representative Barnhart.
And this may not be the right panel to ask this, but this bill was presented to me basically as a way of dealing with the legal problem that counties have of protecting discretionary immunity in situations in which they're a contractor with the state. Are there other ways of getting at that specific legal issue that we could use instead of this bill? Has anybody asked that question? Do we have legal opinions about that? Because that's the way it was presented. That was the issue that the counties told me they were concerned about.
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, there have been extensive discussions between attorneys at the Department of Justice and county councils about this very issue, and certainly everyone is not satisfied where those discussions have gone or where proposed contract changes between the state and the counties. But, I mean, that discussion is very much alive, and I think it's germane to our continuing negotiations, and if we get together with also representatives of the governor's office, I think we will try to find every possible solution we can. But your question really is more of a legal issue that I wouldn't be prepared to respond to.
Okay. Well, then I have a comment, and this is not a question. I don't want to have us use a bill like this as a way of changing the fundamental relationships between the counties and the state on a whole variety of different programs under the guise that what we're doing is dealing with discretionary immunity. If we have to go to some of the approaches that we're being talked about here, I'd like to know that we had to go there because we were boxed in and there was no other way to get there. The issues that you've raised, the issues that were raised a minute ago by the Commission on Children and Families, these are existing relationships that have been worked out painfully over a long period of time in the legislature and in other places. And while I don't, it's certainly clear to me that there's no intent on the part of the bill writers to interfere with those relationships. To the extent that the bill actually does that, I would consider that a flaw in the bill.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Barnhart, I just might comment as well that I think that those concerns would be those that would be addressed in the proffered meeting with the governor's office.
Yeah, good.
Representative Berger?
Yes. I think that all of us are very concerned that our services continue. I think sometimes we get lost in the process of how things work. And everybody has their own concerns, and I'm very happy that there will be some discussion that will take place. As a legislator, I do have to tell you, however, that I am very dismayed when I read in the paper about our federal match monies and that we have looked at loopholes or we have not done the things that needed to be done. And I think as we move forward with our concerns about services, we need to be very sure that we dot all the I's and cross all the T's, and that as a legislator, I am not embarrassed by that. And I don't say that to you personally. I just say that as an overall comment, and I'd appreciate it if you wanted to comment or respond.
Madam Chair, Representative, I mean, we appreciate those comments, and I think historically we have sought every opportunity to maximize federal match, and the particular issue I think you reference is a loophole that certainly was allowable under federal law, and whether or not Oregon sort of exceeded what is allowable is what's being debated right now, and it's between attorneys and negotiators and all that, but I think it reflects the fact that we have sort of desperately tried to leverage our precious state general fund dollars in every possible way, and if we've sort of overstepped our bounds, then we're going to have to renegotiate that. But that certainly was the intent.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, thank you. let's see, let's get Scott Taylor up and Judith. I think Judith's last name, Potassi? Putas, sorry. And for those to testify still, and I think for our members as well, the testimony that we've heard so far indicates that there's work still needed on this bill, and there are agencies' concerns. The governor's office has concerns, as do, I think, even proponents have concerns on this. So maybe in the remaining testimony, if we can just kind of shorten it up to be in the context of, you know, maybe a discussion about, you know, what the issue is for your particular agency or other interest, and then I think knowing that, just having that on the record, then ultimately we know there will be future meetings to try and bring this together to make it work a little better, so we can kind of resolve or wait for other questions and getting into the side issues maybe for another day. So, Mr. Taylor?
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, I'm Scott Taylor, the Oregon Department of Corrections. I will say that the testimony I've just had handed out, there was, I didn't get the dash twos clearly adjusted in my testimony, so in the second paragraph, second sentence where we refer to indemnity, as I understand it, in the dash twos, that has been removed. So that's no longer an issue with us. Allowing the counties to selectively opt out of portions of the intergovernmental agreement with the department is what we're concerned about, and that is in Section 13, Subsection 2, and there's an A, B, and C. A quick version is that A basically says that the counties, if the money drops below current service level, have the option to opt out. That was part of the Community Corrections Act, 1145, passed in 1995. Legislature been wrestling with that particular issue. Sub C, the new sub C, indicates that there's negotiation between the county and the Department of Corrections about what services can or can't be provided. That would allow us as a Department of Corrections and the county where particular situations arise where we might find some economies or some different ways of doing business locally. And that allows the dynamic tension, in our opinion, of the opt-out to keep us both at the table and talk about it. And if we can't come to agreement, then it returns to the state to try to manage with that funding. The greatest concern in Section 2, Section 13, Sub 2, for us is B. We have talked to AOC, and we understand that there's some willingness to work on this particular piece of it. What that basically allows from our perspective is the ability for the county to determine which of the people and the 30,000 offenders out there on supervision, which of those they would or would not decide by each county's choice with no standard definition and decision about who and who those people are. We have concern because this doesn't tie back to other statutes that people that are sentenced are still required to be on supervision. So a bill that allows someone not to supervise, then who does have to supervise? Our legal counsel right now is kind of of the opinion that we inherit it back as a state, and that would be our concern, that if a county chose not to manage these folks, we as a state would still have an obligation because they are sentenced to a period of supervision, particularly under guidelines and with Measure 11. And that creates a patchwork quilt for us in 36 counties to try and figure out which population, how we manage it, and we, of course, would not have the funding because that would be the issue that would be driving this. We don't think that that provides the best community protection in that model. The second area that we want to specifically address is in subsection 4 of 13. And as I understand it from conversation today, there was a little error in the drafting, or there should have been a 2B as to the 90-day ability to give 90 days notice. If 2B is what that refers to, I've just talked about 2B in our concerns. The way the bill currently stands with just the 2 in there, that would mean that anybody who made any of the decisions about operating differently because of a reduction in current service level, that would mean that, in our opinion, that we would then only have 90 days to take care of the transfer of property, personnel, vehicles, caseloads, all those sorts of things, which may be fairly complex on a short version, and again, endanger community public safety. And that's why the original bill does have 180-day. We recognize we may be a little different than some of the other agencies because we do have the opt-out clause, because we do have some specific requirements about provision of services, and we have some legal questions that we would have to spend a little more time with our legal counsel on. And those, in the short version, are our major concerns.
Okay, questions? All right, thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, Chairman Doyle and members of the House Rules and Public Affairs Committee. I am, for the record, I'm Judith Wu-Puchas. I'm a resident of Lake Oswego. I'm here today to testify in opposition of House Bill 3638, and as a Clackamas County resident and native Oregonian, I have a family member who suffers from a serious mental illness. I find it untenable that the budgetary crisis experienced by our state and our counties has resulted in House Bill 3638. This bill shifts responsibility for mandates covering mental health, developmental disabilities, children and families, civil commitment, and local public health services from counties to state, subject to the availability of monies from the general fund. As much as I sympathize with the financial plight of the counties and legal liabilities, county community mental health services provide timely, frontline, and critical services for the mentally ill prior to catastrophic episodes, which require expensive treatments and services. My family member is delusional and suffers from depression. She's homeless right now, She's unemployed, she denies that she has a mental illness, and she refuses treatment. When she suffers a major psychotic episode, as we expect in the near future, we fear that critical mental health services will be unavailable because of the shifting of responsibility for these services as the general fund monies decrease or in such short supply that they will be unavailable. Currently in my county, Clackamas County, the county mental health center will close 3 out of 7 community mental health centers and lay off 70 staff by June 30th. Inadequate funding, relinquishing responsibility for critical mental health services will result in suffering for the mentally ill. Therefore, I respectfully oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you for your testimony. Phil Lemon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Phil Lemon, the Executive Director of the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission. I'll be very brief. Criminal Justice Commission administers juvenile crime prevention grants that go to every county. Excuse me. Like the Commission on Children and Families, we were brought in quite late to this discussion, so I appreciate hearing the testimony you've heard today. I would just briefly like to echo the concerns that the Department of Human Services discussed about having a coordinated system and a statewide policy. The issue of liability has never come up in the discussions with counties in our administration of the juvenile crime prevention grants and the series of budget reductions we've had over the last biennium. I would just note to you that the dash twos and the proportional reduction provisions in them do not apply to section 12, which is the provision in the bill relating to juvenile crime prevention grants. And just we would hope to address and resolve these questions in the work group, and I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Okay, thank you. No questions? All right, thank you. Appreciate you sticking around. And Dennis Mulvihill.
Good afternoon. Dennis Mulvihill, Washington County. Washington County supports this bill. One comment I think that needs to be said here in closing is that we're not trying to change the relationship fundamentally, Representative Barnhart. What we're trying to do is clarify that there are programs that counties deliver for the state of Oregon. And if the state wants to cut those programs, then we'd like to be able to get out of the way, not backfill them, and not get sued. And we thought that the language got there. I note in listening to the folks from the different agencies is that the things that they found that were problems were things that we stuck in there as in an attempt to try to make this more palatable. And, you know, we stubbed our toe on that one. In other words, we were trying to say, okay, if we need the ability to opt out clarified, we would also like the ability to come back and say, look, we don't really want to opt out, but can we do something less than that? And the language we stuck in there is the ones that virtually everybody is talking about. So, obviously, we can either get rid of that and make it very, very simple and say, subject to the availability of funds, and clarify the opt-out. And then one final thing, and in Washington County, and this is dealing with the Children and Family Commission, Washington County contracts most of its services to not-for-profits. So we do the planning, and then we contract out the services. We believe, based on conversations with county council, that we are vulnerable because we do not have, subject to the availability of funds, in the statute, the same thing that the state enjoys when it cuts back on funds, and we would like to have that placed on all of those services that we do for the state. Planning is a service. you're planning for the delivery of funds, and the money flows through and goes to not-for-profits. If you cut back on those, you still have got a problem if somebody does something naughty and there's a lawsuit that comes out of it. So let me just stop there and try to leave it in the place that what we wanted was to define the relationship and making it consistent across the board. And these other issues were more of an attempt to try to make it more palatable. So we'll figure that out in the work group.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Barnhart.
Let me just say that the second or third sentence you spoke, which I can't quote back to you now, was what my understanding of the bill was, and I applaud that goal, and let's see if we can't get there.
Thank you. And to the end of having a, I guess, Rules Committee sanctioned work group on this, my understanding is that's not necessary, that the governor's staff is working with the counties and all the agencies on this issue already. Mr. Cantine, are you looking for a time frame at least? I mean, an expectation? Okay. Do you see a need to take this more than an additional 2 weeks from today? Okay. Let's plan on that as far as a report back from the work from your group, and then we'll go from there. All right. That then concludes the public hearing on House Bill 3638, and we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 272. All right. Colleagues, we have two different amendments that we are looking for at Senate Bill 272. Interesting, the Senate Bill 272 came over to us as a gut and stuff from whatever that original bill was. We are not going to be moving the Senate version that came over, so we have entertained at least two other options, and those are contained, I think,
A4 and A5
amendments. So for purposes of the public hearing, all we're going to be discussing are the A4 and A5 amendments. And to that end, first we ask Senator Beyer to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 9. I'm here with the dash A4 amendments to Senate Bill 272, which I assume you all have a copy of already, and I have talked to each and every one of you about them also. What this amendment does is to fix what I'm going to say is a lost opportunity for people who live in predominantly rural Oregon in small areas. We've handed out to you is a chart that lists the counties and the school districts in each of those counties that would be affected by this bill. And I need to make one clarification on line 13 under Lane County. It is not Blahee, it's Blatchley. There's a typo there. I apologize for that to all the residents from Blatchley School. But what this shows is that there are 53 schools and school districts in the state of Oregon that would be affected by this amendment, the dash A4 amendments, which simply changed the charter school law we have. Under current law, there has to be a minimum of 25 students in order to qualify to become a charter school. And what this amendment does is say that in school districts of less than 250 students, there is no minimum number. The minimum number will be specified by the charter. In school districts of more than 250 schools students, it would retain the minimum active enrollment of at least 25 students. And where this is important is that we've got places in the state that have been prohibited from having charter schools because of this floor requirement, because until January of this year, there was also a cap where a maximum of 10% of the students of any one school district could leave a school district to go to a charter. It's not actually leaving a school district because they're still part of the school district, but leave the normal, if you would, public school in the district to go into a charter school in the district. So you had a situation where school districts of 250 or less, the parents or the patrons there in the district were not eligible to create charter schools. That cap has sunsetted and is gone, but we still have in areas of the state where you would have to go for hundreds of miles to find potentially 25 students to qualify for a charter school. And I don't think it's this body should be penalizing students who may, you know, of parents who choose to live in rural, remote areas. You know, we should be there facilitating their educational opportunities, not hindering it. And that's what has happened to some of these areas. Specifically, I know of a situation where on a gravel road, the people are approximately 40 miles from the local school. They're homeschooling their children now. There are approximately 10 students in the area, all being homeschooled, and they would like to be to see if they can start a charter school, and they've been prohibited from doing so because they don't have 25. Well, there isn't 25 school or students within 100 miles of them. So for them to do that, because actually where they are, I don't know, the entire school district even has 25 students in it. So we have this sort of a problem, I'm going to call it, and we could fix very easily by just eliminating this floor of the 25 students. As you see on this list, what's interesting is one of the schools on this list in Lake County, Paisley, is going to become a charter district, which Representative Barnhart probably knows quite well because he did represent the area for a short time in his legislative career when the Secretary of State determined it was best for someone from Eugene to represent Paisley. So actually there are 53 schools on this list, but one of them is actually already going to become a charter district, so it doesn't qualify. And there are a couple of them right approximately, the like in Baker County, Pine Eagle, where they are 249, and this is estimated enrollment of June this year is where, and I got these numbers off the Department of Education webpage, so that may go up or down a little bit. But I think the important thing is here is what this amendment will allow is for those people in those areas to be eligible to have an enhanced educational opportunity for their children. And I think that is the goal of our charter school law, and we should try to, if there's problems with it, look at them and fix them. So I believe this is a relatively simple fix and a good fix, and it should increase educational opportunities for all students in the state. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I know nothing about the other amendments that are coming forward.
Thank you. Any questions?
Just a quick question.
Sure. Representative Moss Anderson.
So say French Glen, it has 14 students, and they want to have a charter school there, and seven of those students are going to become, you could potentially have a school that would take half of the people from French Glen. Wouldn't that sort of make French Glen unable to operate?
Mr. Chair, Madam Vice Chair, I think that I'm going to let the people from OSBA talk about that, but the important thing is here is this doesn't change anything on local control. It's still up to the local school board to grant charters or not. They have to look at financial viability of the school and everything else that's still in the charter school law. Potentially something like that could happen, but it's a contract. And you understand, these rural communities like this where there's only 14 students in French Glen, if 14... you know, if the parents of 14 or 7 of the 14 students decide they need to have a charter school, quite possibly and quite probably, maybe the entire district would say, well, maybe we should become a charter district, such as is happening in Paisley. But those are local issues and local decisions, and we should not be standing in the way of those. We should be helping to facilitate them.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair, members of the committee.
Appreciate your patience. Now for an introduction of the Dash 5 amendment. Bruce Anderson and Bill Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, Bruce Anderson with Speaker Karen Minnis's office, here to discuss and testify in support of the -A5 amendments to Senate Bill 272. Representative Backlund is familiar with this this wording because it's basically House Bill 2600A engrossed, which passed out of the House Education Committee unanimously but ran into a slight little delay, or a delay. On the -A5 amendments, basically I think the bottom line issue here that we're talking about is to helping improve advanced technology education and training opportunities here in the state. Career and technical education has many benefits and ramifications for our state. It will be a critical part of our state's future. It will increase our state workforce, and it will contribute to the economic vitality of communities throughout the state. And additionally, skills acquired through career and technical education will help our children entering college and university. The bill as amended with the -A5 amendments will help our state's high school juniors and seniors to be better prepared for life after high school, whether that's in the workforce or getting a jump start on a college or university education. That's, I think, one of the reasons why that attracted Speaker Minnis to this issue, which she's been working on for some time now, based on the experience she had in high school, where she was able to get involved with a dental assistant program, and after she was married, that came in very handy in helping with her and her husband and just starting out as a married couple. So being prepared for life after high school is wound up being a huge benefit for the speaker, and I could say that she would want to extend those opportunities to our future high school classes as they prepare for the future. I want to just concentrate on one little element here that I think we're talking about, and that is diversification of our state's economy. And especially in this current recession, it's going to become ever more important that we have businesses and industries from a variety of fields. This concept, which came out of Mr. Lesch's Center for Advanced Learning, which we'll talk about in just a moment, is very important and will continue to help diversify our state's economy. So, and I think it's been clear what we've seen, that new industries will have needs to be met that involve advanced technology, which will become critical to our economic revival and success. So we need to prepare for that and have provide for educational opportunities in this field. And it helps promote, the -A5 amendments help promote community solutions, creative community solutions to this. We've seen this creativity in East Multnomah County, in the communities of Troutdale, Fairview, Wood Village, and Gresham. A broad range of people came together from local school districts, from Mount Hood Community College, OHSU, city governments, local high-tech businesses such as LSI Logic, Boeing, and others, to coming together to develop the Center for Advanced Learning. The center has begun and will have its eye towards providing programs in information technology, medical and health careers, and pre-engineering and manufacturing. And I really believe it really goes to demonstrating how we can increase student learning and achievement, increase the number of students pursuing advanced specializations, as well as serving as an example of how to become a regional education business industry partnership model for the 21st century. And that's what is envisioned in these amendments. With that, I will basically just turn that over to Bill, and I appreciate your support and would be happy to answer any questions.
I just want to fill in a little bit of detail. I'm the director of the Center for Advanced Learning, and it will be opening in the fall. We have already admitted 250 students. We are an approved charter school. We have a separate governing body that oversees our school that's separate from our elected officials. We are pursuing programs beginning at the junior level in the three areas that Bruce mentioned. And I think I'd like to go in a little more depth about what students will be doing in the community. In IT, students will actually be developing and administering and managing webs for small businesses. In at least East Multnomah County, 75% of our economy is small business. And we think we can provide a great tool for them to have in their businesses at no charge whatsoever. We sponsor 100% of the effort to them to have a web, to have the information in their web managed continuously for the duration of the operation of this school with the student expertise that we have at the school during their junior and senior year. We think that's a pretty big give back to the community, and we think that's a pretty big spin-off in terms of economic vitality for those small businesses. In addition to that, we have a critical shortage in healthcare. We are ramping up with great speed the ability to get more students trained and prepared to assume the roles that are desperately needed in the healthcare industry. We have increased the capacity at the front end of students that want to be in those fields, and we are increasing the training possibilities for students to get to the degree level faster, to be able to be in the clinics and hospitals that desperately need their services. We found with students, they want to do intentional work. They also want to graduate from high school. They also want to be able to do their extracurricular activities. We've created a model that allows them to do all of that. And the students have found this to be a very attractive model, and their application and admission has indicated their sincere effort to want to achieve in this kind of an environment. Questions?
Okay. Any questions? Representative Close?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this is very exciting, and it's interesting to see how you've done this. I have a question on page 4 in section 6B, and it says that the grant or loans awarded under this section for the purpose described in paragraph AD may not exceed $25,000. I just wondered why you put the cap on that particular area. I'm not sure. I can't figure out which AD it is.
That 25.
Or line 9. Huh?
That particular grant and loan program has a cap of $25,000 already in statute, and so we're just quoting that already exists in here. We will look at other ways to be able to put these partnerships together beyond just that particular grant and loan effort.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Further questions? Representative Barnhart?
Oh, thank you. I'm wondering if you could describe just a tiny bit more about your organization.
Sure. Be happy to do that.
Well, you've even got a flyer. Okay.
Keep prepared.
Maybe you don't need to describe it at all.
Our organization consists of a governing board with our superintendents, our college president, and beginning in the spring of the first year of operation, we will also have representatives from our business community, our parents, and our students that will represent the governing group of this school. It is a very flat organization. Beneath the governing board is a director, myself. Beneath the director is instructional staff. That is the hierarchy of the organization. It's a very cost-effective way to do business. It is a way for us to get the maximum amount of dollars into the classroom where they ought to be, and to be able to really focus on the outcomes that we've sat down with industry to develop. Because we believe that education can have a tighter connection to industry standards. I also want to say this school has a dress code. The industry standards are the dress code of the school, and there are no exceptions. There are no blue hair, there are no piercings, there are nothing that the industry would find distasteful. I had that explained to a parent group about 3 weeks ago, and a gentleman waved his hand, and I called on him. He asked to buy my dinner because he was so thrilled that we were holding a standard of accountability for young people that had a reason for it. It wasn't because we want to be arbitrary or take their civil rights away. There's a reason for them to dress professionally and behave professionally.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Montes Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I was on the school board, Gresham Bartlett School Board, when this idea was born, and have been a strong advocate for it. And just to put on record, it includes Corbett, Centennial, Reynolds, Gresham Bartlett, and working actually very closely with Mount Hood Community College also and getting their input. And I'm extremely excited about this. I think it's a model for the state, and it's going to provide jobs. More jobs means more money coming into the state.
Okay. Representative Backlund, deja vu for you?
Thank you, Chair. It's hard to get ahead of Representative Barnhart, so I need to jump in here. I'm sorry, Representative.
No, it's fine. You're right. I apologize. Well,
you don't need to. Actually, I just wanted to say that the House Bill 2600 did come through the Education Committee, and we had a very good hearing or hearings there. I can't remember if it was, I think it was two.
Mm-hmm.
And we were very favorably impressed, and so I'm pleased that, and it passed out of our committee, I think unanimously, and so I'm very pleased that, House Bill 2600 is being reborn in the form of another gotten stuff. It's nice to see you again, Bill, and to be advocating for the Center of Advanced Learning.
Yeah. Mr. Anderson?
Well, I just one comment I did want to point out, and that is Representative Backlund alluded to the work that went into House Bill 2600 A and Gross, and there was considerable work. We pulled together basically the effect, whom I would say would be the affected groups and individuals and so forth, from the Oregon Community Colleges Association, the Oregon School Boards Association, Associated Oregon Industries, the American Electronics Association, the Department of Education, and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, as well as Oregon Education Association. We worked out what I think is a great package that you have before you today. There were a lot of folks that worked on this and are continuing to support this. So just wanted to add that also for the record.
Okay, thank you. And I'm assuming you're not indicating that the Department of Education or the OEA supports this at this point.
Since the Dash A5 amendments. I checked in with all of the folks.
A5s, I'm sorry.
Yeah, the A5s. I checked in with all the folks that we worked on in a work group on that led to 2600A.
Okay, I apologize for that. Representative Close?
Yeah, I just had one comment. I really would prefer that you would change the name from Cal to Or.
Yeah. Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I hadn't gotten that far. All I wanted to do was to find out when the branches in Lane and Linn counties were going to be built.
Well, it's interesting because I have had people come and visit from a variety of school locations around the state and even beyond the state already. Even though we haven't educated our first student, there are people that want to replicate what we haven't done. Now, I don't know how that works, but I'm confident we're going to have a strong program. I'm confident that students and parents have made choices based on a belief that there's a solid education program there. And it is very replicable in a variety of community settings. It doesn't have to be in the metro area to be successful. And the reason we wrote the bill the way we did is to allow local communities to drive the conversation around what it is that should happen in that community. And this allows that to occur with intentional investments. And that's the whole urban-rural piece can come together if we do intentional investments starting at the community level.
Yeah, thank you. Okay.
Well, just one additional comment, Mr. Chair. I was on the school work committee of the Eugene School Board for 3 years. It was like pulling teeth trying to come up with models that might actually work. Just a quick preview of this one, and what we've heard makes me very excited about the model, and I applaud what you've done so far.
Thank you.
I hope, in fact, that it works as well as we mutually think it might.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for testimony. Let's return back to the Dash 4s. There are two folks in opposition to that. Steve Novick, Department of Education. Lori Wimmer Whalen. And let's start with you first, Mr. Novick, and if you have any comments on the Dash 5s, you're welcome to make those comments. Otherwise, if you're just here to testify on the 4s, that's okay, too.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Steve Novick with the Department of Education, representing Superintendent Castillo. And Mr. Chair, as to the Dash 5s, my understanding was that folks at our office were following that, and I certainly accept Mr. Anderson's representation that he's talked to them and they're fine. As to the Dash 4s, Superintendent Castillo is opposed on grounds essentially of efficiency and economy and the message that we're sending to the state about how we're handling dollars. There was an audit that was done by the Secretary of State, I think in November or December, that addressed the question of the percentage of school district costs that go to instruction as opposed to non-instruction. And you can debate what could be categorized as instruction and what's not instruction, but clearly there's administrative costs, there's costs of buildings, there's costs of transportation, which are sort of adjunct to instruction. And what the audit found is that exceptionally small school districts had an exceptionally high ratio of non-instructional costs. They're taking sort of fixed costs and spreading them out over a small number of students. So their non-instructional costs are high relative to their instructional costs. If you allow for the creation of really tiny schools, schools of less than 25 students, in the context of really tiny school districts, what you're doing is pulling them out of a small school district, leaving that school district with spreading costs such as the cost of buildings over an even smaller number of students. And I think that the result would be that you'd see the non-instructional cost figures in those small districts go up even further. And that's a major concern that Superintendent Castillo has about this bill. I mean, it's the same concern she'd have about anything which sort of moves us further towards breaking districts and schools into smaller pieces, when at least derive an argument from the audits that we should be going in the opposite direction. As you know, there are districts around the state where small schools are closing because the districts find that, you know, financial grounds, that's the only thing that they can do. The superintendent also feels that she recalls she was there when the charter school law was passed. She thinks that this was an item of a considerable discussion at the time, and she feels that the law isn't all that old, and she'd like to see it continue in its current form for some time before making changes like this. Thank you.
And questions? Okay. Ms. Whalen?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen with the Oregon Education Association. I wanted to make sure the record was clear that we enthusiastically support the -A5 amendments and have supported it all along in the form of House Bill 2600. And not only do we support it, but we'd hate to see it encumbered by the -4s because reluctantly we have to oppose those. And I thought I'd give you a little bit of the reasons why. As Mr. Novick just told you, the economies of scale issues are pretty critical to us, particularly in a time of a financial crisis such as the state is in right now. As you may remember, since the passage of Measure 5, the state has been moving to consolidate school districts. We had over 300 at one time, and it was felt then that because of economies of scale, we just couldn't afford to have so many little itty-bitty schools. And now it seems like with some of the proposals that have come forward, we're reversing that trend, and at exactly the wrong moment when we can least afford to do so. That's why the Oregon Education Association, in fact, requested a bill this session to retain the two caps that were referred to earlier in the charter school law that kept the limits where they needed to be, explicitly for financial reasons. The Oregon Education Association does support charter schools, but we also feel that they can't be a threat to the regular school program because we care about all the children in Oregon and the quality of an enhanced educational opportunity for every child, not just those in the particular choice option schools. And for that reason, we have some concerns about the per student cost, both for the new charter school that might be created were the -4s adopted, but also for the existing program left behind. On one hand, it might be true that it would be a collection of homeschool families that would seek the public monies for a charter school, but once established, of course, there would be students from the regular program who one could fathom would also then choose to attend, which means then you've got a very tiny school with brick and mortar costs, with staffing, and children, you don't just lose a whole fifth grade. You lose kids all over the system. And what that means then is it's very difficult to back out your costs of doing business to be responsive to the loss of even a few children. And that's why when the charter school law was established, we found the 25 student threshold was established to protect precisely against this kind of thing from happening, so that these very tiny schools for whom even a loss of a few students would have a distortedly difficult financial impact would be most affected. And that's why that limit is there. Not to deny children opportunity, but rather to make sure that the opportunity for all children in the district is a certain level of support. Now, the argument was made to us that the local school district would still have the ability to stop a charter if the financial circumstances were as I've just described to you. But the charter school law does not allow the school district to disallow a charter solely on the basis of the financial issue. That's how the law reads, and that's just the way it is. So it is not true that that is a circuit breaker, if you will. And that's why we unfortunately will have to oppose the Dash 4s, and we would respectfully ask that you pass in the Dash 5s to 272, but forego the opportunity on the other one. Thank you.
Question?
Yes.
Just a quick question. It's my understanding that when a charter school is proposed to the school board, it has to go to the local school board, and then the local school board will say A or nay. And I know you're saying that it's for it can't be made on the basis of financial reasons, but wouldn't you think that a school board would deny it if they felt it was going to disseminate their own school district?
Madam Chair and Representative Melissa Sanderson, it is my understanding that they can't do it unless they have also violated other criteria. And so the circumstance would then be the appeals process. And so our concern is that even if a school district weren't amenable, the charter starters could go up the system.
Additional questions? Thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Jim Green, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I've also brought up at the table with me John Marshall. He wanted to make a couple of comments on the Dash A4s. We are in support of the Dash A4s as amending the charter school law, and I'd like to address a couple of the issues that have been brought forward. On the issue of whether a charter school application, my name is Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. Sorry, Madam Chair. On whether a school district can deny a charter school application based on financial reasons, there is criteria in ORS Chapter 338 that a school board must use in determining whether a charter school can be established, and that is financial stability. One of the criteria they have to look at is the charter school going to be financially viable and stable. Charter schools in a K-8 environment get 80% of the general purpose grant per ADMW. For a high school, it's 95%. If you take some of these small school districts that Senator Beyer handed you, and you take Troy up in Wallowa County, who has 5.5 kids roughly, if they wanted to start a charter school for two students and they had a budget that was $10,000, and they only get about $5,000 a student, that's probably not going to work financially viable, because 80% of the $5,000, it's not going to pencil out. I work with probably 22 school districts across the state on charter school applications. This is something that school boards take very seriously when they take a look at a charter school application. They don't allow for the creation of ones that aren't going to be financially stable. They don't allow for ones that aren't going to provide a comprehensive educational program. They also don't allow for ones where the value of the charter school is outweighed by a direct, significant, adverse impact on the quality of education for the kids that are left in the district. That's specific statutory language in ORS Chapter 338. That's criteria school boards have to use when they look at a charter school application. You have on this list several school districts here that are really small. And you heard from Senator Beyer that the Paisley School District is going to be the first charter school district in the state. And that's true. These small communities, and I spent two meetings out in the Paisley community on the issue of charter schools, won't create a charter school without community buy-in. And we had two meetings where the auditorium at the Paisley High School was packed with over 300 people in the community, where they had questions, they had concerns. The board, the schools, the students, the teachers, the classified employees in that school district all came together and said, yeah, this is something we want to do. I've gone to Camas Valley down in Douglas County and Dace Creek. They're looking at the same thing. They're looking at potentially not having enough state revenue to run their regular school district, so they're thinking about creating a school-wide charter. And they're doing it to access federal money. They're doing it to add program. Paisley, oddly enough, one of the comments from the gentleman from the Department of Education was on efficiency and economy. Paisley's main reason for becoming a charter school district, they lost their library media specialist. One of the standards that's in the Division 22 standards of the Oregon Administrative Rule says school districts have to have a library media specialist. They asked for a waiver from the State Department of Education saying, we can't find anybody to come to Paisley to be our library media specialist. We have a woman who's retired from the Lakeview County Library and would like to come be our library media specialist, but she doesn't have a license. Can we get that waiver? The answer from the Department of Education was no. The charter school law allows them to have a person in that position without a license. It was their way to keep being viable, because being a non-standard school district, you can have state school fund dollars withdrawn. When they went to their largest employer in their community and said, we're going to have to close down our school district, the U.S. Forest Service, the large employer, said, if you do that, we're moving to Lakeview. The Paisley community said, if you do that, we're done. They came together as a community to do a charter school. The folks that you heard from Senator Beyer in the rural parts of Harney and Malheur County, they're homeschool students. That school board is trying to figure out a way to bring them back into the public school realm. A way to do that may be to create a charter school for them, but our law right now doesn't allow them to do that. This is a waiver or a change in the law that would help those very small rural school districts that have small numbers of students in their community to create a charter school if they want to do that. Believe me, in these small communities, you're not going to do this without buy-in from everybody in those communities. I've been in many of these small communities when they're talking about charter schools, and if there's opposition, they drop it right then and there. You have to have total buy-in to make these programs work for these kids. I'd be happy to answer any questions, and if Mr. Marshall has anything else to add.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. And for the record, I wanted to indicate that I was the individual, along with the help of the Senate Education Committee, responsible for the original gut and stuff of Senate Bill 272. And for the record, I'd like to indicate our support of the regutting and double stuffing of Senate Bill 372 by the -4 and the -5 amendments. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Mama Sanderson.
Thank you. I'd like to know how many charter schools are now in the state, how many have failed, how many are thriving.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mona Sanderson, we currently have, I believe, 22 that are active. We have had one that just recently was not renewed. That was a decision made by the Eugene School District last week with regard to the Pioneer Youth Academy. We have had one other school district, Corvallis School District, did not renew a charter. They gave them a two-year opportunity. The Eugene School District also gave the Pico Charter School a two-year opportunity, and they didn't meet those accountability standards. When they didn't meet them, they didn't renew their charter. There have been now, I believe, there were three additional denials just recently by school districts on charter school applications that they're going through the mediation process. If they are not successful in mediation, those applications then are before the state board to take a look at. We have had now two that were denied by school districts that have been sponsored by the state board. In one instance, the state board said, your criteria did not meet the statutory regulations. Would you like to review that? That school district said no. In the other one, the Portland School District, and I believe it was the, was it McCoy? No, it was, they changed the name of the charter school now, but they could not come to an agreement. The state board has gone ahead and sponsored that. They've negotiated the charter, is my understanding, with the Attorney General's office. It'll be opening next fall. As of next fall, we'll have 27 charter schools online, is my understanding.
And 1, 2, 3, 6 that have failed.
And there are currently no, when
not renewed.
Ms. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, two that have been not renewed. The other ones were applications that were originally denied, never started. So you have two that have had their charters not renewed. You had another one, the McCoy Academy in Portland, where they actually not renewed midterm with that group.
Okay.
Just further discussion, Representative Barnhart.
Just another clarification. Where was the other school that was denied, but sponsored by the board, state board.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, that was in the Ontario School District.
Ontario.
Okay. It was a dual language immersion program.
Representative Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jim, a statement was made that there was a concern that all children in a district wouldn't have an equal opportunity because of this amendment. As I remember it, charter schools are selected, the students are selected by lottery, and so even in these small districts, wouldn't there still be a lottery system so that all students had an equal opportunity?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Close, if there are more applications than slots available, you must conduct a lottery so that everybody has equal opportunity. If, say, you're going to start a charter school of 25 and there are 25 applicants, you don't need to do the lottery. It's only a lottery if there are more applicants than slots available. But the charter school law also says one of the laws that cannot be violated, that is not waived in our charter school law, is the law in, I think it's back in ORS Chapter 639, that deals with equal opportunity for students to go to educational programs, so they have to comply with that. You cannot deny someone access to a charter school because of the constitutional reasons.
Thank you. Okay.
Further questions? All right, thank you. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, while Representative Butler is coming up, I thought for a moment we were back in the basketball season. We were stuffing and restuffing. I thought the NBA was finished. But anyway,
boxing for
dead. This could be the World Wrestling Federation. We're gutting and gutting.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Butler from House District 60, and I come today in support of the -A4 amendments that that Representative or Senator Byers brought to you. For the small school districts that I represent in Southeastern Oregon, and I used to actually represent the folks in Lake County where the Paisley School District is located, and I know that Barnhart has been very active out there as well, and I do appreciate he was the first state representative that got to fill that auditorium for the first time in many, many years, and I do appreciate that, but recognize too that when we do have these schools in these remote locations, many of those schools become, in addition to being the center of the community and the school of the place of knowledge, also become the boarding school for the community. And I do have students that travel a good long distance to come to school, and the state transportation or the state DMV actually issues driver's licenses to some of these young students so that they can travel in on Monday morning. I have students that travel as far as 145 miles on driving themselves on Monday morning and then turn the keys into the school, and then on Thursday afternoon, then after classes, after lunch, then the keys are returned and then they travel back. And these aren't huge populations of folks, but they are populations of folks that live in rural Mountaineer County and rural Kearney County that but for the opportunity to draw together to be able to make these opportunities available for these young folks through the opportunity of a charter may not otherwise have the opportunity. And so I came today to testify on behalf of the -4 amendments. I'm anxious that these folks have these opportunities. I think that they will draw their communities back closer together so that I'm not sending some of the students out for long distances to get educations in a larger school. I say larger school, that's a school of maybe 112 or 115 students, but be able to draw those students together in pockets of as few as 25 to 30 students. And we're not talking about 6 or 7 room schools. We're talking about 1 and 2 room schools in portions of Southern Oregon. So I encourage your acceptance of the -A4 amendments.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Representative, do you have some specific examples of where this law might be used? Some places where it might actually happen. The reason I ask the question is I'm a bit skeptical of taking a tiny school district and dividing it up even more financially.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnard, I think as probably as represented by Mr. Green previously, you probably will not see a division of those school districts. Any present division would be a combination of three things. The students that are there right now that are receiving school through a one or two room school arrangement, a second group of students who are presently transporting themselves long distance to go to a boarding school, and a third group of students who are off the record that are presently receiving it at home. And I think that what happens is that this unifying factor will draw those communities together. So I don't see it bifurcating any schools that we have presently. But as to your specifically, I can imagine that probably down in Diamond and Fields, A-Rock, there's another small school that probably could attract some of the homeschoolers, and I'm not sure how many, but there's only 12, and they do a one-room school. It's in a place called Sucker Creek, which is down in the Hawaii Badlands in southern Niagara County.
Okay. Further questions? All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Mayor.
Andrew Henderson, why don't you come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Andrea Henderson, Executive Director of the Oregon Community College Association, which represents the 17 community colleges in Oregon. I'd like to testify in support of the -A5 amendments today. The community colleges are very supportive of this legislation. We believe it's an important step forward in offering technical education in Oregon. As you may know, our community colleges see as a vital part of their mission to offer technical education, and currently over a third of our FTE is in professional technical education in Oregon. And we believe this bill will help create stronger ties between the K-12 and the community college system to help advance technology education in Oregon, which we believe will help support training people for jobs that are here today and jobs that will be here in the future for Oregon. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Seeing none, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And Harvey Matthews, planning cleanup.
Hey. Thank you, Chair Doyle. Representatives of the committee, my name is Harvey Matthews, representing Associated Oregon Industries, which represents over 23,000 of Oregon's businesses, employing over 325,000 of Oregon's private employees. And I want to state for the record, our members are highly dependent on the quality of education provided by Oregon's public schools. As such, I want to support both the A4 and A5 amendments to Senate Bill 272. I think these two are follow the same theme. They both stress the importance of innovation within the public school system and focus on serving the needs of students and their parents. And to that end, I want to say a few words first regarding the A5 amendments, and then a few words about the A4 amendments. We strongly support the passage of the A5 amendments. These amendments are the result of collaboration, as you've heard, by education business, Department of Education, legislature. This bill arose due to the shared belief that if our state does not establish clear commitments to specialized skill development and career education in high school, Oregon's economic vitality will suffer. With the A5 amendments, the goal is to increase the number of students taking rigorous academic curriculum so that they are fully prepared for college without needing remediation, and also prepared for high-skilled entry-level employment. By increasing student choice among rigorous high school programs, accelerated transitions to college, and technical programs of study, we hope to increase the high school graduation rate, reduce the need for remediation, and increase the economic vitality of our communities. Technical education is already working very well in Oregon schools, but it's a quiet success. In 213 of Oregon's high schools, over 7,000 students in 2001 took advanced courses that gave them dual credits, both high school and college, thus saving Oregon families over $1.1 million in course fees at other institutions. The A5 amendments would create a fund that would give grants and loans qualifying partnerships as they develop and start their advanced technology training programs, thus saving family education dollars and improving the technical skills of our students. So your yes vote on the A5 amendments will result in more students taking rigorous academic curriculum, improving their readiness for college and the workforce, and improving the graduation rates of Oregon students. And in regards to the A4 amendments dealing with the charter school legislation, this is a red letter day. I was very surprised that both the OEA and the Oregon Department of Education would support a position that would encourage homeschooling. But that's what I heard today. The number of homeschoolers coming in to the system and strengthening the public school system from this bill far outweigh any potential effects of the cost of administration to just 50 school districts. We have over 200 school districts, and while I agree that the lack of instructional dollars getting to the classroom is a problem, this A4 amendment does not exacerbate that problem. If that problem needs to be addressed, it needs to be addressed across the system with all 200 districts, and that can be done, but this bill does not negatively affect that. And that's some of my comments.
All right. Any questions? Okay. Thank you for testimony. No one further scheduled to testify. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 272 and we'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 272. And colleagues will address the -4 amendment first, then -5 after that. Ask Cindy Hunt at least to come forward. If there's some technical advice needed, we can go through that with her on if we actually combine these two amendments. So, Representative Forrest?
Mr. Chair, I would move the -A4 amendments.
Move adoption. Representative Forrest moves adoption of the -A4 amendments to Senate Bill 272. Discussion? Representative Moss Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've gone back and forth on whether to support or not support the -4s. But what I come down to is they're really, even though we so want to collaborate with the urban and rural, I really feel there's a difference between urban and rural school districts, and sometimes the urban or the rural school districts do not have the advantages. The fact that the charter school bill or statute states that there has to be community buy-in, the school board has to buy in, that I am going to support these amendments. Our economy is such that I think we have to give our smaller school districts as, you know, many advantages as possible, and I think this is one way. And it only affects very small school districts. I mean, the small, small ones.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Well, I don't want to take much time, but I will say that I find persuasive the arguments of those who indicate that reducing the size of schools is moves things in the negative direction. And while I certainly sympathize with the idea that it makes sense to have additional schools in widely scattered areas, I think we get to the point of diminishing returns very quickly. And in those areas, and once we get below 25, I think we're well past the level at which a school can possibly be viable, and I don't intend to support the A4s.
Okay. Further discussion? All right. Let's call the roll.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
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 Excused. And chair votes aye, and we adopt the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 272. Representative Forrest.
Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules to conceptually amend the -A5 amendments.
Representative Flores has moved to suspend rules to conceptually amend the -5 amendments. Discussion on suspending the rules? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move to amend the Dash A5 amendments to delete lines 26 through 28 on page 5. Regarding the effective date.
Okay, Representative Flores has moved to amend the Dash A5 amendments to delete lines 26, 28 on page 5, which relate to the effective date. And Cindy Hunt, can you explain this one to us?
Okay. Cindy Hunt, Legislative Council's office. The Dash A4 and Dash A5 amendments that you have before you have two different effective dates. The A4s have an effective date that's effective on passage, so literally the day the governor signs it. The A5s, they're effective on July 1, 03. Obviously, the two dates at this point are not that far apart. Are you sure? So, ultimately, it doesn't really matter that much which effective date you go with, but they should be consistent because the whole bill needs one effective date. So, in keeping with that, I had suggested to the administrator that the effective date upon passage would be the one to go with because that doesn't harm the A5s in any way.
Okay, thank you. Discussion. Representative Barnhart.
Well, this may be out of order, but I have a question about how we deal with the fact that both of these amendments appear to be designed to replace the whole bill. And I'm assuming we need another amendment
to deal
with that issue.
And that comes next. We first have to...
All right. Yeah. I'll be quiet.
All right. Other discussion. Okay. Any objection to amend the Dash 5 amendments to delete lines 26 to 28 on page 5? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Flores?
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the amended A5 amendments with the direction to the Legislative Council to combine the amended Dash A5 and Dash A4 amendments that replace the original bill with an emergency clause that takes effect on passage.
Okay. Representative Flores has moved to adopt the amended Dash A5 amendments with the direction of the Legislative Council to combine the amended A5 and A4 amendments that replace the original bill with an emergency clause that takes effect on passage. And discussion.
Mr. Chair, I presume we could give great credit to our committee administrator for putting all this together. Is that right?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, I think we could do that. Yes.
That's right. For this and many other things, but and I frankly think, you know, what better way to gutting stuff, than to even make it more complicated.
Mr. Chair, if you like, I have three or four other things.
Out of order. All right. Let's see. Any objection to moving to adopt the amended A5 amendments as described? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill, Senate Bill 272 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Flores has moved Senate Bill 272 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, I'm a strong supporter of the A5 amendments, and you've heard my objection to the A4s. I'm going to vote no on the bill today for the purpose of making certain that there's a full discussion in other forums about the bill before the vote. I may actually support it on the floor.
Okay. Further discussion? Very well. Let's call the roll, please.
Aye.
No.
Aye.
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 Excused.
And
chair votes aye. And Carrier, Representative Close?
I'd be happy to.
All right. Senate Bill 272, as amended, is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And we close the work session on Senate Bill 272. And colleagues, got one more thing for us, opening up a work session on a drafting request. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move we request Legislative Council prepare a draft measure as outlined in the memo to Speaker Minutes dated June 19, 2003.
And quick discussion on this, colleagues. The House Bill 3442 is a bill that's currently in Ways and Means. It's relating to the establishment of the Wine Board as a semi-independent agency, something that's already passed out of our committee and as a courtesy went to Ways and Means just because there were some Department of Agriculture FTEs that needed to be shifted around and before we moved it to the floor. So that's getting bogged down in committee. It actually did not have to be referred to Ways and Means in the first place. We only did it as courtesy, and yet now it's being hung up potentially. So we just want to make sure that there's an opportunity to get the bill drafted in case we have to use it for getting it to the floor and then over to the Senate. So any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. With that, no further business before the committee. 3 hours later, appreciate your patience, colleagues. We are adjourned.
Yeah.